black thing go from left to right, and I thought, I'm going to die out here. No one's ever going to know.
And I couldn't believe what my eyeballs were showing me. I'll never forget how evil the eyes were. It was horrible. I mean, I've never seen nothing that evil.
It ran towards me at a rate that I can't even explain. Turned and stared at me. And this look of, I just want to kill you. I want to say it was human, but it wasn't.
He was yelling at me to grab a gun, grab a gun. I was like, for what? He said, just grab a gun. And there's footprints all the way to the door of my house. It had went inside my garage all the way to the door.
911, what are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better... Sheriff, see ya.
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
You're listening to Sasquatch Chronicles. Check us out online at sasquatchchronicles.com. If you've had an encounter, email me. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. Got a great show planned for you tonight. Going to be speaking to Dr. John Bendernagel, who is from Canada. He's a fan favorite. I know the audience absolutely loves him. Last time I had him on, people demanded I have him back. And it's like I was telling John, you know, you got to give the mob what they want. And they definitely want to hear from Dr. Bendernagel. And so I want to thank him again for coming on tonight. And if you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And I want to let everyone know out there, my heart and my prayer goes out to everyone on the East Coast, especially in Florida, with the hurricane coming. There's a lot of people that sent me emails, said, please do a show on Sunday, which I always do, but it'll give them a chance to get their mind off things. And it just meant the world to me that people would email me in the midst of a hurricane and want to make sure that there's a show. So thank you so much out there. Please be safe to the audience listening, especially in Florida. Remember, possessions can be replaced. Your life cannot be. And do whatever you can to stay out of harm's way. My heart's and my prayer go out to you. But fresh off the International Bigfoot Conference, I want to welcome Dr. John Bendernagel to the show. John, thanks for coming on. Again, I really appreciate it.
Hi, Russ. Thanks very much.
No, you're doing good. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. My voice comes on and off a bit weak, but I think I can speak up.
Oh, no, you're doing great. You're doing great. Good. Have you been tracking this hurricane coming, John, the hit in Florida?
Sorry? Have I what?
Have you been tracking this hurricane coming here in Florida?
Oh, very much so, yeah. And I feel like you, my goodness, yeah. Quite a wall up there in the southeast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's my heart. I've never actually lived through a hurricane, but I've always said about people in the middle of the United States, they live in a tornado alley. And, you know, a lot of these things, I don't know that I could, I mean, I think I'd freak out in a situation like this. We just had the fires here in the Pacific Northwest, and it was raining ash down like snow, and I feel bad complaining about it, especially since there's a hurricane about to hit, the largest hurricane ever is about to hit Florida, so I feel terrible even complaining about some of the fires. But thank you so much, John. I appreciate you being here tonight.
Well, thank you.
And I know we're both off the International Bigfoot Conference. I know you were there. A lot of great speakers. I didn't get a chance to see anything that you presented. I was over in the vendor area. But walking away from this conference, John, and thinking about this conference, what did you take away from it?
Well, I'm still processing that because, you know, you go there and, you know, and we had some really good teaching. I guess that's what, I mean, Jeff Meldrum always gives a good presentation. But Cliff Berrickman talking about the anatomy of the Sasquatch hand based on 13 casts. I didn't know there were 13 hand casts of Sasquatches. And Cliff's very good at teaching and working away on that. And then the other one for me was, well, several, but David Ellis talking and pulling together all these I won't call them all vocalizations because some of them were percussive sounds. So And he's David's very good. He's very conservative. He said, you know, these are recordings that have come to my attention. We attribute some of them to the Sasquatch or Bigfoot. Others we're unclear of. And he's doing largely what I think I'm trying to do, bring this forward for the attention, well, in this case, of bioacoustics experts who can say, oh, that's actually been documented as so-and-so. Here's a recording. Let's do comparisons and let's look at the spectrograph. So that's progress. And that, so that's really exciting. And I guess the third for me was that, David Floyd, coming from a university in Eastern U.S., the Sasquatch, well, the hominid images in the literature, and he went way back, and he's dealing, like I have done with Aboriginal accounts, yes, this is embodied in myth, and yes, are we dismissing it too easily as merely a supernatural being or a hallucination, or should we be taking this as more seriously, early knowledge or early pointing towards current knowledge? So good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I really walked away. I really enjoyed what little I heard of it. And so much evidence. And you're right about David Ellis. I know he's with the Olympic Project and I'm sure he's listening, but David's one of the best ones to send. If I had some true audio I needed analyzed, I would send it to David Ellis. I've seen him at work. I know sometimes you hear. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, he's my guru. Yeah. He helped me a lot. He came early to a conference the other year and spent a whole day with me. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, no, I know I do different mixes with audio, and like on the last couple of shows, I did a thing with the Ape Canyon, and I know people are amazed by it, and I'm like, you should see what David Ellis can do with audio. if you think what I do is good, you should see what he can do. Was there anything that, what was the main thing that stood out to you, though, from the whole conference? Was there one thing you walked away from that you couldn't stop thinking about?
Well, it keeps going back to that same old thing. There I just talked about, you know, two real, basically, tutorials, lectures, especially Cliff and David. And at the same time, the skepticism persists. I come home into what I call the real world. You know, that was kind of a three-day, almost in isolation there. I come back to the real world. And, you know, so that's, to me, that's difficult because I don't have to back way off from, I don't have to, but it seems that there's a necessity to back way off from, so say Cliff talking about the hand there, to this, does this thing exist or not? And, you know, all the emails I'm dealing with and all the, apologetic emails I'm dealing with now saying, gee, I don't want you to use my name, but here's what I saw, you know. And I got a real good one from BC the other day, and I'm actually thinking of heading up there because it's recent, 2 weeks, good sighting, you know. But the guy didn't have his cell phone with. I don't fault people. No one's expecting to see wildlife that needs photographing. But you know, I had this distressing thing, and I might have blown it. With a CBC Canadian Broadcasting Station found out that I was down there at a U.S. conference, and they're here right here in Vancouver, BC. And they called to do a 10-minute radio interview for the BC Coast area. And I said, well, great, love to do it. And I should be ready. But the woman, very, very good journalist who interviewed me, he started off, so you're at this gathering of believers. And I said, oh, gee, she doesn't know how offensive that is. She doesn't know how hot a button she's pushing. And so I tried to say, we actually don't consider ourselves believers. You know, we actually consider ourselves investigators, and we work on evidence-based investigation. But I'm afraid it got my back up, and I haven't actually heard what came out. It seemed okay, but I said to my son, I think I might have sounded a bit ranty. You know, well, that's what so-and-so thought. It was a bit of a rant, Dad. Oh, shucks. I mean, with you and your listeners, I think you understand why I tend to rant, and maybe cut me a bit of slack. But here's this journalist expecting a nice review of what the Sasquatch looks like and what sort of evidence really is there. And I'm thinking, oh, we are so far past that. But then that makes me sound delusional. You know, either ahead of the curve or delusional. And, well, you know, the easiest answer for that one. So, anyways.
Yeah.
So I'm still working through that. But you know, but that's good. It's good when that happens. because I'm kind of out of the loop here, and I need to know what's bothering people, and, you know, can I address it?
Yeah, no, and I'm glad that you came on. I asked the listeners for some questions, and there's definitely some great questions from the listeners. But, you know, there's a lot of skeptics that show up at those conferences. I talk to many of them, and I love skeptics. I absolutely love them. They have some of the best questions. They don't have any preconceived notions about anything. And I actually like speaking to skeptics, not so much like, you know, someone who's just down on the topic that wants to tear apart everything you say. I'm okay having an argument with someone like that. But the skeptics themselves, if you know, the people on the fence, they don't really have a dog in this fight. They haven't ever seen one. And they're kind of on the fence. They don't really believe, but they don't really disbelieve. Those are my favorite people to talk to because, you know, you can share so much with them, and then they tend to walk away and go, wow, I didn't know that there was that much evidence regarding this creature. And I didn't realize that many people had seen this creature. That's the other thing, too, when you talk to a lot of these skeptics. They're shocked that many people have seen him. You know, I guess they see the Patterson-Gimlin film, and they think, well, that's pretty much all that's happened in the last 50 years. But a lot's happened since then.
No, gee, that's good, Wes, because you're right about skeptics. Yeah, I mean, gee, anyone who turns up at a conference, now that's open-minded, healthy skepticism. That's what we encourage. You have questions, raise your questions. You have doubts, express those doubts. We need to address them. Can we address them? You know, so really a lot of people who consider themselves skeptics are really agnostics in the sense that they're not saying, no way, can't exist. They're saying, I haven't seen enough evidence, or I haven't been convinced, or I need to learn more. You know, and this it comes back to my rant, but I don't see a whole lot of scientific colleagues there saying, "Gee, these people may have something to say to us, and we may be missing it." But anyway, let's cut that one off right there.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the hand. I didn't get to hear that presentation. I just had a gentleman on, and I want to come back to it, Richard. I had on Friday night show where he had a good look at three of these creatures, a young one and two adults. And remind me, I got a question for you about that later. But he was talking about the hand. And as we were talking about the hand, he said, you know, Wes, the thumb isn't exactly in the place where our thumb's at. It's actually a little bit lower. He said, but their hands are like catcher's mitt. He said this thing could walk up, scoop up water and drink out of it. And it was that thick of a, that deep of a hand when he looked at it. What was it about Cliff Breckman's presentation or him talking about the hands that stood out to you?
Well, you mentioned that the thumb is not positioned like it is in the human. It is down up towards the wrist. That scoop-like aspect of the hand that you were talking about, that's come up in reports. And there's I know one eyewitness drawing. It's actually from Ohio. Very much shows a scoop-like hand, large scoop-like hand. Yeah, you mentioned the size of a catcher's mitt. Gee, there's that report from the 60s from with an eyewitness drawing, a prospector from British Columbia here. And he actually, this thing was standing across a pond from him, sort of rocking back and forth, upright, hands and arms swinging slowly. And he said, and the hands were like canoe paddles. I mean, they really impressed him. So it's not just big foot, it's big hands. And in the sense of maybe being disproportionately large compared to a human. Yeah, and Cliff mentioned another thing, like sometimes the fingers appear short. And he said that's probably webbing at the base of the fingers, where we have slight webbing, we as humans, there seems to be more webbing. Yeah, you know, it's stuff, and it's coming forward like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then seeing the actual hand track. You know, I stopped and talked to Cliff, and Cliff is actually a really nice guy. I've never actually talked to him before, and I was a little taken back on how... I don't know why I was taken back, but he was actually a really super nice guy, and he was kind of showing me some of the different track casts. And one question I want to ask you, Doc, is, you know, I had Richard on Friday night's show, and I'll send you a copy of it if you want to listen to it. I know you're on the site, too, as well, but he had talked about seeing this young one and it looking like a monkey. He said it looked very much like a monkey in the face, except for a human nose. Now, he had actually seen the female had actually walked over, crossed his path. They were out hunting, crossed him and his friend's path, walked over to the tree, and actually got the baby out of the tree, and it climbed on the mother's back. But one thing he said is the mother's face looked very human-like. The other one was a little, the male was a little bit more scarier, a little bit more dirty, a little bit, and he went into details about that. But the part of the encounter I found fascinating was he talked about the young one looking very much like a monkey, and as the adults looked very much human-like. And I almost wonder if they grow into their face or not. I don't know. That isn't the first time I've heard that. I've heard that about four or five times off the air from other eyewitnesses that have seen the young ones and said they look like monkeys. And then the adults look like humans. What's your take on that, Doc?
No, that's good. That's good. And, you know, it's one of these questions. But, you know, it's interesting. If you get reports of, like, well, infants or juveniles, they you know, they're maybe still spending most of the time on all fours, not totally upright as they become subadults. Yeah, and I've got a report from here, and it was, well, he said baby chimpanzees. So that was his take. Again, very, very monkey-like. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, I mean, we do have these discrepancies, especially the nose, when it comes to facial features. Some say ape-like, some say very much more human-like. Okay, and then this thing about the nose. Some say, oh, very flat, simply two outward-facing nostrils, like the face of a gorilla. And others say, oh, no, a definite sort of structure, more like a human nose, and downward-facing nostrils. So, is it variation that's going on, or just not misinterpretation, but differing interpretations? I don't know. But, you know, I actually went to something because you asked the other day when we were just talking a bit about nomenclature, rules of nomenclature. And see, the group I use is, it's called hominoidea. Well, first of all, primates, since we're all primates. And then hominoidea is apes and humans. And now that's as far as I go. I don't want to go further into making it, calling it an ape, or as others do call it, a human, because it gets us into divisiveness within ourselves, and that's, I don't think we don't need any more divisiveness. So I backed off from great ape and say, well, if we can say anthropoid, that includes, and it leaves room for these human-like features without saying, if it's got human-like features, it can't be an ape, or if it's got ape-like features, it can't be a human. We're not there yet.
Yeah, I think even, you know, if I look at chimpanzees, and it's kind of crazy I'm in this field because I'm not a huge fan of primates. They creep me out for some reason, Doc. I don't know why. They just do. Like when I go to the zoo and stuff, they just kind of creep me out.
It could be what?
The actual, like when you look at chimps and apes, they kind of creep me out because there is a lot of human in them. And I, you know, even with great apes, the known great apes, and with chimpanzees, there's a lot of human-like behavior with them, too, as well.
Oh, yes.
So I don't think there's a big difference in the primate world since we're all primates.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got an invitation a few years ago to speak at a local university, and the class was primatology. And it turns out that the students were in what is called early childhood education, and they were being taught primate and including ape behavior to understand kids, you know, hitting out and intimidation behavior. And I thought, whoa, that's pretty broad-minded because, you know, we're usually not very willing to learn much about humans from apes. But, I mean, you know, most scientists, certainly anthropologists, physical anthropologists, do not draw that bold line between humans and apes any longer. You know, this is kind of a continuum. But, you know, we get into trouble when we start to kind of catalog, because I'm reminded of a really good investigator I spent time with back in Ontario, Central Canada. And he kept saying, and I was calling them mammals, and he said, oh, sorry, John, I really can't go with you on mammals. It's definitely, you know, he was very, very human-like. And I said, well, Mike, even if it's a human, it's still a mammal. We humans are mammals.
Yeah,
he said, okay, then. But, I mean, you see, this is the problem because we haven't engaged our scientific colleagues who could really speak eloquently, like Jeff Meldrum does, on the subject. People, you know, they're out there, and they're kind of missing some of the basic stuff. We should not be arguing about mammals. If they got hair and they're warm-blooded, they're mammals. That should not be controversial. So that's why I'm reluctant to take it down too far within primates.
Yeah, no, and I understand that. I think that there's a lot of behaviors you can draw between the Sasquatch. You know what shocks me, John? I know you're a wildlife biologist. The one thing that surprises me the most about Sasquatch is you will find it acts very animal-like in a lot of situations, very much like an animal. And then there's other situations to where it acts very human-like. And I can't really – I'll give you an example. The guy I had on Friday, Richard, probably one of the best encounters I've ever heard. And this female Sasquatch had walked over, grabbed the young one, taken it out of the tree, put it on its back, and it just looked at him. And I was telling Richard, I said, you know, if that would have been a black bear, if that would have been any other predator on the planet, you probably would be dead. Because they don't, you know, bears, chimpanzees, I mean, any known predator out there is not going to tolerate you being that close to a young one. They're just not. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this thing didn't attack him kind of threw me off. He reached for his knife. I'll tell you, John, he reached for his knife. And he said the female Sasquatch gave him a look like, don't do that. And that really stuck with him. And that's very human-like. I mean, that is very human-like to get a look from a creature and know right off the bat it's a look like, don't do that. And so that throws me off with the Sasquatch. What are your thoughts with the behaviors being human-like and animal?
No, you raise very good points because we – And this is this thing about we draw this line between humans and apes. I think without a very full understanding of apes, and I include myself in that. You know, although I worked in parts of Africa and did see chimpanzees, I should have gone to observe gorillas in the wild, and I didn't. I didn't know I was going to get into this area of research. But anyway, humanly, those primatologists who study ape behavior, they see human-like, well, what we would, you know, popularly describe as human behavior all the time. And this is what Jane Goodall keeps emphasizing. You know, these apes, they need this kind of social stimulation and psychological stimulation. You can't just put them in a cage and expect them, you know, to thrive, because they don't. They, you know, and there's this strong maternal instincts. There's just assistance with each other, a lot of stuff going on. And so we have this unfortunate popular conception of apes as knuckle-dragging brutes, you know. And she, Jane Goodall, is one of the ones that, no, we must get over that, you know. They're much more human-like than we realize, but it's not maybe quite as widely known as people like her realize.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You've looked at that Coco the Gorilla, John, haven't you?
Yeah.
Coco. Mm-hmm. There's a famous, and I watched this on the video, and I was really blown away by it. And it really opened my eyes as far as, you know, my dog, for instance. I love my dog like my son. There's nothing I wouldn't do to protect him. There's nothing I wouldn't do to, you know, make his life easy. But, you know, a lot of times as humans, we look at animals and we think of them just as like animals. And I remember Coco was smoking one time, or no, she was trying to get out. She was actually, she was halfway out the window, and the people had stopped her because she was living in this enclosure and with the people. They had stopped her and they said, well, what are you doing? And she said, I'm going out for a smoke. Well, she was breaking out to leave is what she was doing. But the fact that she signed back to the humans, I'm going out for a smoke. She had watched the humans go out there for a smoke. It blew me away. It completely blew me away. It made me stop and go, well, what is human? What is it that we're – what defines us as human beings? You know what I mean?
Well, you see, that's good. And I think part of that defining, and you know, and it comes up in cultural anthropology, just like you talked about your dogs as animals, but the implication is we're not, we're human. Well, this is the same thing. Again, we are animals, you know, I mean, we're mammals. So, anthropologists, cultural anthropologists keep getting, well, I won't say they get us into trouble, but one of their really popular cultural explanations is that we humans have a need to separate ourselves, and they say, from animals. And I think what they really mean is from other animals. And we embody this in the Bigfoot or the Sasquatch, which bridges that gap with what they consider animal-like qualities and behavior and human-like behavior. And so that sounds good. And then so other scientists say, oh, thank you very much, cultural anthropologists. I think we now understand how we have Bigfoot in our culture. That's a good explanation. No. Well, I don't know if we humans have this need or not, but I don't think it is a very good explanation in light of all the physical evidence we have. You know, the tracks and the eyewitness descriptions that you're describing, the vocalizations. So, but we kind of allowed ourselves to be stuck there. And I wouldn't like to say it myself, but I heard others say, yeah, scientists being intellectually lazy. Well, maybe that's it. Just take the easiest solution and make that a conclusion and say, that's it. Sorry, it's me going on a bit.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Wow. You know, I think as humans, we tend to, and I know there's a scientific term, I think it's anthropomorphous. You know, we tend to put human-like characteristics on a lot of animals. I mean, I do it with my dog, and so when people do it with Sasquatch, I completely get it. I mean, I'm not too hard on people when they do that because I think my dog understands what I say. He understands my body language. He understands, and he probably doesn't. He probably has no clue, but I feel like he does, you know, and I think that's more of a human thing than it really is on him. It's more on me. And I think a lot of people with Sasquatch, they do the same thing, whether they think it's an animal, whether they think it's a person or people, whatever people, you know, call them. It depends on your experience with them, and it depends on how you view that relationship. And so, you know, I'm not too hard on people when they I used to be, John. I used to be really hard on I'd be like, no, they're animals, nothing more, nothing less. And today I'm a little bit, maybe I'm getting soft in my old age, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, me too, because I mean, you know, we can, I think no one should be faulted for their interpretation, because it's basically open season on how you interpret Sasquatches and Sasquatch evidence and what you hear, because I mean, it's, you know, since there's so little informed scientific comment available, you feel free. I mean, just, Yeah,
and I think with eyewitnesses, you know, because we don't have one in a cage we can study. I always say I don't have one in my garage I can study, but with eyewitnesses, it's like I was telling Richard on Friday night show, you know, I was asking him what his opinion on Sasquatch is, and he was like, well, I'm not in a position to speak about that. You're in the absolute position to speak about
that. Yeah.
Most of the eyewitnesses or most of the true fans of the show probably know more about Sasquatch than most researchers out there.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can learn so much about the behavior. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's why I'm so glad that you're archiving and pulling these reports out of the human population, because we will return to those. You know, you can probably tell the whole focus of my research these days is that, you know, okay, for some of us, it's been discovered. We moved on, just like Cliff and David Ellis. We moved on in our studying hand anatomy, vocalizations, you know. But that leaves us so exposed, you know, standing out there sort of naked, looking over our shoulders, saying, what are we doing out here looking delusional? And maybe I take that on too much. And that's another good thing about these conferences, like you say, certainly skeptics there, but lots of young people, very, very open, not with all the hang-ups that my colleagues have. And much more amenable to this. No, I guess it's still an alternative explanation beyond it being merely a cultural phenomenon. So, yeah, good stuff, Wes. Yeah,
and that's why I like having you back on the show, John. You're actually a huge fan, especially with college students. I had a lot of college students contact me, and they were having their professors listen to the show. And especially when you're on, they have their professors listen to the show. They're like, hey, if you don't want to listen to eyewitnesses, listen to this guy. And you're right, there's a younger generation coming that is more open to take a look at this and not so afraid of, I think the generation of scientists that are afraid to look into this are dying off. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I'm going through this with Jeff Meldrum, and he's invited editorials for the journal RHI. And, you know, I'm really I'm not coming out of the closet. I'm out of the closet with my acceptance of this, but I'm getting a little more ready to start poking at my scientific colleagues for their unwillingness to scrutinize the evidence. And like, I've been so deferential, I'm, you know, saying, and this is what gets me into trouble. You know, I say, yes, I understand and your resistance to this. Yes, it's partly justified. It does seem like a far-fetched claim. And then again, this investigator I work with back east, and we said, and I have said this another time, John, I understand your need to appease your scientific colleagues. Well, there's another hot button. I don't want to appease them. I don't want to look as if I'm enabling them to remain silent and uninvolved. I'm trying to attract their attention. So I don't know if I saw my little presentation. I was trying to poke a little fun at them in that little sort of satirical cartoon I presented. So that's what I'm sort of going next, because I'm encouraged by these younger people, because we have senior curators of mammals, senior scientists in physical anthropology, basically pronouncing what is acceptable, what are acceptable subjects for scientific investigation and which are not. And they're absolutely silent on the Sasquatch or Bigfoot, and I want to address that, because that silence speaks volumes. It says, no, this is not a subject for scientific scrutiny. It doesn't warrant scientific attention, and basically, I don't want to hear any more about it. So, but behind all those scientists are younger colleagues, interns, grad students, and a minority of people, even my age, like Veldum and I, say, whoa, you're speaking for us, and you're not representing us. And that's when Meldon's more successful at this than I am. That's why, permit me to address your next conference so I can illustrate some of this evidence, and not convince you of our conclusion, but show you the evidence and why we think it warrants investigation. So I'm nibbling at the edges of my cage here, coming out a bit, so starting to poke a bit.
No, I think it's smart, John. I really do. And you know, a lot of times that's been my biggest complaint, really, with the science world. Hey, whether you believe in Bigfoot's irrelevant to me. Just take a look at the evidence. Take a look at some of the eyewitness reports. Let's look at some of the track casts. Let's listen to some of the audio. And if you want, we can look at some of the video. But let's just take a look at all of the evidence and then tell me what you think. And I think most scientists are unwilling to do that. And the fact that you're a professional, John, I think he holds a lot of weight when you speak. Holds a lot of weight. You know, this show, for instance, people couldn't wait to have you back on. I have a list of questions for you. I don't know if you want to
sure.
take a knock at some of these. Eric B. from the website, he said, in your knowledge, and again, John, I realize some of these questions are just opinions or maybe some of your theories, and it's obviously neither one of us have one in a garage we're studying, so, but, you know, take a whack at them if you want. Eric B. says, in your knowledge, what incident or sighting or something he witnessed sticks out as the best credible evidence?
I'm thinking, you know, because see, as a wildlife biologist, I tend to place heavier weight on sort of the things that we use as wildlife biologists, like tracks, and especially when tracks are cast, you know, it's really very good. And one of the things I've been doing, and I put it up there at that conference, and I have one of my research videos, is a field guide entry, which belongs in Mammals of North America, right next page to bears, including upright bears. And so I've got, you know, the sort of field guide representations of a Sasquatch and some kind of a sampling of Sasquatch tracks. And, you know, one of them, and more, I'm finally getting some juvenile and sub-adult tracks. And one of the great sort of take-home things from this trip for me was Ori Innes, who I met a couple of years ago at Todd Neese's conference. Well, when I met Dew down there in Oregon, Ori came up to me with this incredibly clear, sharp Sasquatch track, but it's only an eight-inch track. Cast, beautiful cast. And, oh, I looked at it then, and we talked about it, but we were all so busy, I didn't follow up. And it's one of these things where it finally sunk in. So I've got back to Ori, and he sent it up to me, and I now have it here ready to make duplicates of it, like first generation, really good copies from a really good mold that we're about to begin. And then I'll feel more comfortable, because I feel nervous with some of this valuable, scientifically valuable, original casting material. But and that's what I think. Gee, sometimes I feel like, I'm not the only guy who appreciates that's where Cliff Perrickin is doing so well, and Jeff's been doing it for years. But a lot of people don't get it. But you know, those casts. First of all, we can usually refute the hoax, the fabricated wooden feet. And anyway, that's a bit of a story, but we can do that. And now we have this evidence that this is, in fact, a track-leaving mammal. So it just kind of eliminates a lot of the stuff about hallucinations and imaginary beings. So I'll stop there. But yeah, it track evidence right there is, for me, as important as films and eyewitness drawings.
Yeah, probably even more, because it's harder to fake a track cast, well, yeah, I would think, than a video.
It harder to fake if you're willing to scrutinize it. And that's where even Jeff Meldrum has the problem. He cannot get his colleagues from down the hall at his university to come and look at his cast collection. And just one little aside there, that the hoaxes have really set us back, because no scientist wants to look at something and say, oh, gee, looks pretty compelling to me. And then a week later said, ha ha, that one he was looking at, yeah, my brother and I made that, you know? So they're being very guarded, and, you know, with some justification, but it's kind of messed things up.
Yeah, and I can understand that completely. Eric B. also wants to know, and I would imagine too, as a wildlife biologist, John, the trackcast would be the most compelling. They're definitely the most compelling for me, you know, beyond sound. And, you know, there's a lot of things you can fake, but trackcasts are pretty tough. One of the questions Eric B. wants to know is, he says, does the doc believe they knowingly utilize infrasound? If so, to what degree?
Yeah, I can't really speak on. I hear these reports, and they're very, very interesting, aren't they? I mean, people are really affected by what being described as infrasound. It kind of seems to immobilize people, and sounds to me like something you probably need to experience to really appreciate. Because it's kind of like people who smelt that really powerful smell, that odor, and gone and say, oh, it was like 20 skunks, and oh, I almost gagged, and, you know, they were very impressed, and to some extent, vocalizations, so really loud vocalizations up close, you know, but infrasound sounds almost go beyond that, doesn't it? But, no, I'm just listening, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I know a lot of encounters, when you listen to them, it sounds like infrasound sickness that people experience. But you wonder sometimes if that's fear or not. Eric B. also wants to know, does John believe they tend to their dead? There's a huge controversy in the Bigfoot world whether they bury their dead, they eat their dead, or these things just go off into the wilderness and die. I don't think anyone truly knows. But what are your thoughts, John?
No, I tend to favor the last, just because it is remarkably easy for a dying animal, mammal, to disappear. Bears, even bears, you know, and because I know, probably 40 years when I was still pretty active in the field, a lot of it here in Western North America, two bear skulls only. You know, and there's a lot, these are black bears, and there's a lot of black bears out there. Even deer skeletons, maybe 10 compared to, you know, thousands of deer I saw. So, yeah, and you know, bones do break down, especially here in the Pacific Northwest where we live with our acid soils. And but teeth tend to persist, but then once the jaw has kind of decayed or molded or been chewed up by rodents, then the teeth, I think, probably just sink into the soil and pretty hard to retrieve. So yeah, trying to get that kind of physical evidence is pretty difficult.
Yeah, it is. And you're right. I mean, I've never come across, I know you said the teeth last a long time. I've never come across a bear jaw. I've never come across a deer jaw or teeth or anything that's died naturally. Obviously, if a poacher gets it, you're going to find the body. But for the most part, I've never come across an animal that died naturally in the woods. I just haven't. I've spent a lot of time out in the woods. One of the questions Eric B., he asked, does John believe that Sasquatch would eat a human if the opportunity arose?
Yeah, I don't think eat. I think there could be competition, you know, and this comes up. It's just kind of orally documented reports, the stone throwing, which comes up so often. Something is, and this is what we would describe as intimidation behavior. And intimidation behavior, and I really got into this in the first book because all these reports were coming, these reports of large branches being broken as if they were intended to intimidate and be a show of strength and spook someone out of an area, rocks being thrown at or towards people. And yeah, intimidation behavior, and George Schaller was good about this, talking about the mountain gorilla. It basically is to encourage human intruders to leave because there's a food cache or infants or family that they want to protect. And it's not violence. They don't want to eat you or kill you. They want you to leave. And I think that's going on quite oftenly. And I think that's how a lot of interactions occur. We've almost kind of stumble into an area, might be a part of their home range that they've decided is like a territory, a really core area that they're protecting for some reason. I, as far as eating, you know, I think Sasquatches recognize us as, have to be careful here, like kindred, somehow a relatedness. Here we are, upright mammals walking around. And you know, there are these reports that I hate to bring up because it sounds, again, like you're delusional, but these, what Henner Fehrenbach used to call rescuer incidents, where a hunter breaks a leg and something large and smelly carries it back to his camp, sets him down and leaves. A child is lost. Something comes out of the forest, guides the child to the edge of the road and leaves it there where it will be picked up. You know, there are these reports around. And I think eventually we will come to recognize that, you know, yeah, this does happen, can happen. But then, and Jeff Meldrum brought this to my attention again recently, reports from, Uganda and other parts of East Africa, chimpanzees actually attacking children, you know, outside, maybe in the evening, maybe not. But yeah, and apparently there is this, and Jane Goodall acknowledges this kind of, what she calls the dark side of chimpanzee behavior. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's something to be aware of, and I have no idea the extent of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You brought up a couple things there. I have had those reports, like what you're talking about, where people seem to be saved by a Sasquatch. And it's hard to say if Sasquatch is killing people. I tend to think that they do, but it's just an opinion. But you never hear, you know, dead men don't speak. And so it's hard it's hard to know for sure what happened. There's a lot of people that go missing in the woods and under very strange circumstances. And obviously every time we can't blame Sasquatch on it, but there is some very odd reports of people going missing. And it really makes you wonder what happened to them. I want to get to Kenny's question, but Eric B., his last question says, it would also like to hear his take on the sexual aspect of Sasquatch. Are they monogamous with their family, or do they have multiple partners like primates? And before you answer, John, I've actually heard of, I had one report I put on the air, I think it was last week, but I've heard about four or five reports off the air where it seems to be like one female and four or five males, something to that extent, where it's not just one male, it's several males, almost like you'd see with monkeys. But what's your take on it, John?
Well, yeah, no, obviously I don't know, but I also have compared it. I look at, you know, bands of chimpanzees and gorillas, and then that sort of orangutan situation, which interests me, because that's where you have a solitary male, solitary female coming together in what they call a consortship. It's almost like a dating sort of thing. They're together for a while, they mate, and then the male goes off by itself again, and the female and the infant are by themselves. And that last one seems to be the closest model that I hear about. A lot of solitary males, But yeah, once in a while, a group. And one, well, you know, this one we talk about quite a lot, not quite a lot, but somewhat, the name will come. Anyway, it's where there's a female, an adult female Sasquatch and an adult male Sasquatch in Oregon picking up hibernating ground squirrels, digging up hibernating ground squirrels. Anyway, but the situation, so it's two adults and a juvenile. But the juvenile appears to keep the female between itself and the male, as if the male is maybe not quite as welcome in that group as might be. So, obviously, this is where we do get into an area of what I would call speculation. And I know people say, well, it's all speculation. No, no, it's not all speculation. But here we're reaching. But no, I mean, see, these are the really good questions that one would have hoped that by now we're kind of moving a little closer towards than we really are. So I don't know. But there is the odd report of a lot, like 8 and 10. And what's going on there, I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I know Melissa Kay says, Dr. Bendernagel noted in one of his commentaries that wildlife biologists use an animal track as evidence to prove the existence of a mammal in an environment. I was impressed by this because we have some very credible people who've expressed they feel some Sasquatch tracks are more likely real based on their experiences. To name a few who to me stand out in their expertise, Dr. Bendernagel, Dr. Krantz, Dr. Meldrum, John Green, Jimmy Chilcutt, with the combined years of experience being about 200, that is an impressive list of men whose opinion should convince anyone. I don't understand why Sasquatch is so taboo or why so many people are totally closed-minded about it. What is so surprising about another species of primate?
You've just sort of addressed the whole background for my second book. You know, why is it scientifically taboo? And you know, oh gee, when would that be? 2007. I had my that second book essentially complete, and that's when I met Lila Hadj-Cheek, and this was in Erickson Project, and I said, and we got talking. She's a Princeton PhD, and I said, "Gee, Lita, would you be willing to just give a quick review? I've pretty much got this book finished." Well, she applied herself, and basically, she changed the book. She gave me 3 years of editing, and it isn't just I was focusing on the Sasquatch as a scientific discovery, and still did, but she said, "Oh, it's much larger than the Sasquatch. It's about scientific discovery. It's about science. It's about scientists. It's about scientific resistance to a discovery claim perceived as far-fetched, which this is." Well, that was really. It took me 3 years after that to get the book finished, but it changed the balance. The second half of the book basically addresses this issue of scientific resistance. So the problem is, okay, so why is our discovery claim perceived as far-fetched? Well, if I were just an ordinary biologist for the Fish and Wildlife branch here, and someone's talking about a 7-foot-tall, 800-pound, upright, ape-like creature here on Vancouver Island, and it's not in my mammal field guide, I guess I'd laugh and I just move on. But so I'm out there along with a lot of others like you saying, no, don't move on. This is evidence-based. I know it sounds crazy. But by now, I guess what I've been doing is trying to pull all this stuff together and what others are doing and doing a really good job of, except it's all happening under the radar, pulling it together to make sense of the claim.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Is that on track?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely on track. Daniel E., he said, "Hey, Wes, a couple questions." And the first one is, does Dr. Bendernagel believe that Sasquatch might be behind the disappearance of the 411 missing cases that David Pilates talks about? We'll skip that question so the author doesn't get his panties in a wad. Well, but the second part
the answer is I don't know.
But the second part of the question is, we know the government is trying to keep all this a secret, but in his opinion as to why they don't acknowledge the existence. And that's the question. Why doesn't the government just come out and say that these things are real?
Yeah, this is an area where I try to be careful, too, because it can sound like conspiracy theory that, you know, this is being known about but kept secret. And that may be the case. But I myself, I'm not going to go there because I have come to realize the strength of scientific resistance. And I'm finding that resistance alone is enough to account for, well, what I'm increasingly referring to as a botched discovery process, where we've allowed ourselves to bog down with a lot of red herrings, well, like hoax tracks and sort of. And it's not that we've stopped, scientists have stopped any progress. They never got started. So,
yeah.
Excuse me, and that's what I'm trying not to do. But yeah, anyway.
No, I understand. I understand. Joseph K., I'll come back to the question, but he says, from the information out there, it appears they are nomadic species. With this considered, one must then move to the question patterns related to hunting, gathering, available shelter, and mating safe harboring for the birthing and rearing of their children until one is old enough to migrate. His question is, and I've had this question before, I've had people who claim to have these around their property, John, and when they come around their property, I'll ask people, is it pretty much 365 days a year? And they'll say, no, it's only during the fall, or it's only during, they'll give you some sort of time frame of when they're seeing these things. Joseph's question, though, he says, I'm curious to know if Dr. Bendernagel has looked into researching potential migratory patterns of the Sasquatch.
Good, really good question. And again, it's an area where we should be by now. And see, I look at the Sasquatch as probably having a really large home range, so large that it would appear to be nomadic, even though it might be actually confining itself just to a large home range. And then within that home range, there will be, like with black bears, I forget what they term it, but there's a name for it. It's maybe not territories, but scattered areas of concentration where food is available in a certain area, at a certain time of year. And so there is a regular pattern of movement, except that, first of all, we're not studying it, and second, it might be quite large scale. But there are some folks working, I know, down in Washington on that, I'm trying to remember the people involved, making maps and mapping reports. We'll get to that. I forgot I had another comment there. No, a very, very good question. Not much of an answer.
No, I understand.
There is one more thing. And this was good. And this is, again, the value of these conferences and collegiality. My wife and I cast, we got a couple of really good casts, 1987 in Strathcona Provincial Park. And then I've now dug out another set of casts about 55 miles away, 1993. So about five, six years later, 55 miles away, it looks like the same individual adult, I don't know if it's a male, but it's what are they, 15-inch tracks, about 6 inches wide. And when I showed them to Cliff Berrickman, and Jeff Bell, they all thought, so you got more Sasquatch, more examples of the track of this single Sasquatch. I didn't think of them as the same individual, but we are now. But both Cliff and Jeff and I, this probably is the same. So that suggests if they are, in fact, the same individual, 55 miles for, a home range. Not that we know that this thing was going back and forth, but that it seems to have traveled that distance during its hunting, gathering, foraging.
Yeah, and it makes sense. You can kind of track deer the same way or any other prey the same way. They'll generally come through a certain area at a certain time of year, maybe not the exact area where you're expecting, but for the most part, they'll come through a same general region. It seems like Sasquatch does the same thing, wouldn't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, And that's the predictability we're looking for. And that's where we are moving ahead, you know, obviously not as quickly as we could be or should be. But by these reports coming forward and people, you know, reporting this and people like you kind of pulling it together, we're saying, aha, in this area, we might be able to anticipate Sasquatch presence at a certain time of year. And I'm trying to use that again this fall, because for 2 years now we've had vocalizations on a small island up on the BC coast. And well, 2 years, that's the beginning of a pattern. So I'm going back this year with better recording equipment and kind of forewarned and going in proactively in advance of vocalization report to see, does this individual or group or whatever it is come back to this island every year, and we'll hopefully get higher quality recordings to sort of conclude, are these in fact Sasquatch vocalizations, or is it something else? So yeah, we are progressing.
Yeah, these are great questions. I know Mark S. I don't know, do you know about the Miller document, John?
Not by that name.
Okay. I'll send it to you. It's a document that was, he wanted to ask you your opinion on it. I'll send it to you. You have to tell me your opinion. The origins of where the document came from are shady at best, but whoever wrote this document definitely knew something about the scientific world. Just some of the terms they use, but they talk about Sasquatch. So I'll skip that question. I'll send it to you, John. That way you can.
Okay. I might know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I'll send it to you. Augustine L., who has about 30 questions, but I'll try and cut him down. He said they have a language. They look like us. Are they uncontacted tribe of humans living in our backyards?
Yeah, well, you know, this is being discussed, Sasquatch vocalizations, like what I'm studying, and these loud wailing calls. But then there is this some people call it gibberish, but this chatter that sounds like language. And the question is it language or not? I mean, it certainly seems to be communication. But, you know, I mean, we've had, you know, Ron Moorhead stuff there, the Sierra Sounds, for a long time, and people have studied it, and I'm not quite sure where we've come to with that. And, you know, there are people have said, oh, this actually sounds very much like a known human language, Spanish or some other language. I don't know, you know, I don't know about this. But, you know, I think what someone concluded, just the way it sometimes it's recorded is kind of a back and forth thing, is that, well, there's definite vocal communication going on. So we may not know the exact meaning, but we pick up things from tone, like, is this an adult admonishing or punishing, or, you know, trying to curb in a juvenile or an infant? Really interesting area. And again, the more investigators out there, and again, documentation being so important, if we can get more examples of this, it'd be more to study.
Yeah, I think the thing with the language is it's not too far off to think that these things have a language. I think every animal, I'm like an old man, I'll go out and feed the squirrels. I probably shouldn't admit to that, but I do. with, you know, sunflower seeds or whatever. And I was sitting out, probably a year ago, and I saw these two squirrels chatting back and forth. It was a language. These two things were chatting back and forth. That was my impression, yeah. I guess, of sitting there. But I'm thinking, these things are chatting back and forth. I don't know what they're saying. But, you know, even if a squirrel can do that, you would think that a primate could, you know, have some sort of language, whether it be a gorilla, a Sasquatch, a human, a monkey, you know, chimpanzee, not a monkey, chimpanzee, or whatever. You would think they all would have some sort of language. I think every animal really out in the woods has some form of communication.
That's the thing. And I think linguists kind of maybe not draw a bold line, but it's communication evolving into a language, which is a little more specific. I don't know. Actually, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, no, and I understand. A lot of these questions, like I said, you know, the audience is hungry for information, and a lot of questions can't be answered, you know, as far as what they do or why they do it, but we try our best together.
But you see, this is the thing. It's what we're doing, but very slowly. Again, pulling all this evidence together, But then, and this is where I keep getting stuck, trying to attract the attention of the relevant experts. Like right now, bioacoustics. You know, we've got these great vocalizations recorded in many parts of the U.S., certainly from good stuff from Manitoba recently, the stuff we're getting up the B.C. coast here. But to try to get a bioacoustics expert to treat this seriously is still difficult, in my experience. Especially if we make the mistake of admitting that we attribute this to Bigfoot. Pardon my cynicism, but that tends to shut down a conversation at a pretty early stage.
No, it does. And I, you know, I really appreciate being here, John. I know the last question they have is from Ryan. He wants to know, have you ever heard of a Bigfoot being in the UK, and have you seen a Bigfoot before? Well, his last part of this question is, have you seen a Bigfoot report or Bigfoot before? And I know we addressed that on last show. I guess I'll answer that. John has seen one. He did describe his encounter. But I am getting more and more reports out of the UK, John, and I don't know what to make of that.
Many of us don't. What are your thoughts? Well, you know, I think it's very possible, because there's some from the European continent as well. And, you know, and that whole, well, it's considered a legend in Scotland, that I think it's the old gray man. And but, you know, I think back not that many years, Grover Krantz was very much a leader academically. Was very skeptical of any reports east of the Rockies. Like, he was, he did his work in the West, and he was skeptical about stuff in the East. Well, we don't do that anymore. We find out a lot of the reports from the Eastern North America preceded, you know, those from the West, you know. And look what Cliff Berrickman's done with his colleague down there in Indonesia, in Sumatra, with the Rang Pendek, a great collection of Rang Pendek track casts. See, they've almost jumped ahead of North American Sasquatch research. So, and then Jeff writing more and more about, you know, like hominids around the world and support for them, like the Aaron in China. And then we had that conference a few years ago in Russia with some, you know, pretty interesting evidence from there. So, but you see, I go back to something that Grover said, that, you know, we really have so much good evidence for the North American Sasquatch. We really should try to wrap this one up, so to speak, or work that maybe a little harder. And then once we're, you know, really convinced that this one exists, then we'll say, oh, what about the Yeti and the Aaron, you know, and the Russian snowman? Yeah. So anyway, that's the way I see it unfolding.
No, absolutely. And I want to ask you, what do you think it'll take to prove it, John? I mean, you know, we have pretty much all the evidence we're going to get at this point. I mean, someone might come out with a video that's better than the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I have seen some good videos. But, I mean, what do you think it'll really take to prove this to the scientific community, to the world? Let's put all government cover-ups aside. Let's put all conspiracies aside. What would it take to prove this to a scientist sitting
in? Obviously, the really conclusive evidence is the type specimen, which we would call the cadaver. And, you know, Grover made a case for that. He said, you know, we've got all these track casts, we've got a lot of convincing evidence, but, you know, my colleagues want a type specimen. And he advocated collecting one, which, of course, is a euphemism for shooting one. And he was absolutely hammered. I mean, but see, that was quite a few years ago. And I think back to my upbringing, back in the 60s at university, we collected specimens, and photographs didn't cut it, almost nothing cut it. That'd be a specimen. Well, we've moved on in some ways. But you know, now going through this with kind of the ivory-billed woodpecker evidence, you know, there's some pretty good photographic evidence and eyewitness evidence, but no type specimen. And what would happen to someone who collected one? So it's a real dilemma. And see, my point is not so much insisting on proof as sufficient evidence to shift this into an area warranting scientific examination by my credentialed, much more knowledgeable than I, scientific colleagues. And that's basically all we're, some of us, it's really quite a, I think it's quite a modest goal. That's why I keep in my presentations, I'm simply trying to illustrate evidence to kind of spark their interest. And, you know, there's something going on here that we should know about. Anyway, yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that's been my argument for the longest time is I, and people hate it when I say it. I can imagine what Grover Krantz went through, but, you know, I really feel like, a body is needed. You know, it's to the point to where, I think that's what it'll take for, I think there's a lot of closet scientists. I know you might disagree with me, John, but there's a lot I hear about. I get emails from them. There's a lot of scientists that listen to this show, believe it or not. And there's
I'm finding that out.
Yeah.
Can I interject here? Because something came to me, Wes, and if I still got it, it's gone. Anyway, I had a thought. Oh, The thought is, getting back to, you know, us trying to attract scientists to the evidence or evidence, you know, bring the evidence to the attention of the scientists. We are trying to save their bacon. They are going to have to address this down the road when that type specimen does happen, you know, from a roadkill or some hunter decides it's time to, you know, be the guy to bring one in, whatever happens, there will be that specimen. And we're trying to say, you know, and people are going to say, what did you guys know about this? Didn't you see it coming? And we're trying to, you know, provide them with information to say, oh, yes, we've had a pretty good description of its anatomy, and we knew a lot about the elements of its behavior. At the moment, you know, with due respect, they're not saying that. They're ignoring what we're providing them with. So I wanted to get back to that.
No apologies. And I think a lot of them are listening, though. A lot of them are closet scientists because they can't come out. You know, I can think of three professors right now of major universities that listen to the show. And they love when you come on, but they listen to the eyewitness encounters and they've started to kind of look at some of the evidence. And a lot of it is because of their students.
Well, that was the other comment I wanted to make. And I did mention it to you briefly at the conference because, following the last podcast you and I did, I got this email from a professor at an East Coast university. Early in the summer, he said, I'm doing this honors seminar, and we're addressing several subjects shunned by science. And it said, it seems like, Sasquatch research qualifies as such a subject. So I've sent him a copy of the book, and we're going to get together. But the point is, he heard about it from your podcast. And I thought, well, so you just jumped. I mean, you were really pretty high in my book, but you just jumped way up, you know. So, but you're right. And I would not have suspected that an academic, but he must be a young guy. You know, pardon my cynicism, but I think this is what you're saying. And I think Meldrum's more aware of it because he's more in the loop. Yes, there are these, I won't call that maybe having a closet interest, but an undisclosed interest in the subject. And I'm encouraged. Well, obviously very encouraged by that.
Yeah. And like I said, when you come on, John, it holds a lot of weight. People listen to what you say. And, I think a lot of the, especially professors are changing their mind, but I think a lot of it has to do with, the younger students that are listening that are like, hey, take a listen to this. This isn't, you know, this guy doesn't make a joke of things. You know, it's eyewitness encounters. And I'm always amazed by that because, you know, for a professor, you know, I have a primatologist that listens to the show all the time, and he'll email me maybe once or twice a month and say, hey, on this episode, you guys were talking about this. I want to let you know how it relates to the known primates. Here's kind of what I see. And, you know, that means the world to me that someone would, in that position, would email me and say, hey, listen, listen to the last couple shows, and here's my take.
I think that's what I hope people like you and I are doing, and your people who phone in. We are trying to make it safe to report a Bigfoot, make it safe to bring this evidence forward. This is a positive thing. It's a necessary thing. And I would say it's almost a responsibility, but I don't fault people who hold back. When it comes to responsibility, I lean a little more heavily on the responsibility of my colleagues to acknowledge those reports and address them. But you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, No, I know exactly. And John, it's always an honor to have you on the show. I know you've written two books, and I want to mention them real quick. Back in 1998, I know you wrote North America's Great Ape, The Sasquatch. And then in 2010, you wrote The Discovery of the Sasquatch. I know people can find them on Amazon, but where would you prefer people buy your book from, John?
Yeah, we're turned out not to be very good business people or book marketers. So, yeah, Amazon has the second book, which is the one I keep recommending. We're finally getting, there's only a few hundred copies of the first book around anymore. We're getting it onto Amazon.ca because the books are all here in Canada. So we'll be out there. We do try to ship from here, but we're slow.
Yeah. I appreciate the fact that you would look into it, John, and put your neck out. Dr. Bendernagel, a wildlife biologist who's willing to look into the subject. You're a hero in my eyes, John, and I really do mean that. That's not just lip service.
Careful, Wes. Thank you very much.
But I love talking to you. I know you and I chatted real quick at the International Bigfoot Conference, and I was so happy to have you back on. Like I said, there was I thought there was going to be a riot if I didn't have you back on with some of the emails and stuff.
No. Well, my pleasure, and I don't want to wear out this welcome, because obviously this is a shot in the arm for me, hearing what's bothering people, so that I can say, you know, do I know anything about this, and can I provide any information or opinions? Anyway, so thanks again.
No, thank you, John. Thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, bye for now.
And that's it for tonight, everyone. Remember, if you've had an encounter, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. I actually want to take a moment and give a shout-out to Ronnie. It's Ron Nee. He's on my Facebook. I know he's been a listener to the show for a long time. And Ronnie says, today I'm heartbroken. I lost my little brother, Michael Joseph Nee. Rest in peace, my little brother, my fishing buddy, and my close friend. You're in good hands with the Lord now, and I will always love you very much. Please say a prayer for my little brother, and thank you in advance to my Facebook friends. And Ronnie, you have the prayer, and you're in my thoughts. Thank you so much for Ronnie's normally this easygoing guy. He always leaves me a funny comment, and I was heartbroken when I saw it, because I know the love of a brother. I there were seven of us. I lost my older brother. I won't go into it, but I was completely heartbroken, and it's when your hero dies, it cuts you up. And my heart goes out to you, Ronnie. It's brotherly love is a hard thing. I know a lot of people listen to me and Woody on the show, and it's kind of a interesting dichotomy between two people. There's certain things Woody can say to me that he'll get away with. You know, if someone else said it to me, I'd probably knock their front teeth out. But it's something, you know, my younger brother, Greg, I love him to death. I probably don't say it enough, but, my heart goes out to you, Ronnie. It's, brothers are a funny thing. You know, it's, I can call my brother an asshole. Sorry, audience. I got to talk turkey to this guy. Ronnie, you can call, brotherly thing's a funny thing. You can call your brother an a-hole, but if anyone else does it, they're in trouble. And it's this weird relationship you have with brothers. I don't think most people get unless you have a brother. Am I rambling, Ronnie? I apologize for rambling, but my heart goes out to you. The closing song goes out to you. It's one of my favorite songs. And keep your head up. The sun will rise tomorrow. May your brother rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening. You're in my heart. You're in my prayers. Until next time, everyone.
Call it magic. Call it true. Call it magic. When I'm with you. And I just got broken into two. of all your magic. I disappear from view, and I can't get. Yes, I do.